Okay, so Mark and Alessia have asked me to moderate this question session. So to remind you, this is about asking questions for how long?
For how long?
45 minutes?
Hour and 15.
Oh, 1 hour and 15. 1 hour and 15 to the speakers this morning. And this is Astrid online. Renate, I guess then it was Bob, Luca, and Benjamin. So are there any questions from the audience to start with?
I guess I'd ask one to Ben, but also to Renate on the other side. This 1 over box squared form factor that you parameterize the CD structure looks very similar to the Rieger anomaly action, which also has a 1 over box squared in it. Have you explored that analogy, and is there anything possibly sensible in making that identification? And for Renata, I'd just be interested in her comments on that functional form.
Yeah, so it definitely looks like this operator. But so at the level that we've looked at a point of at the level of a two-point function, we are not really sensitive to these corrections, like the difference between just box squared and this more complicated operator. So this would be hidden in like higher order correlation functions. But it's definitely interesting to investigate some connection there.
And are you able to get a coefficient of the numerator? Presumably you are.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's well enough defined in the simulations because you don't understand what the distance scales are, but will there be a way to compare that with the coefficient of the Rieger action?
You can compute a number. So you get the number from the fit, but once again, as I tried to stress in the talk, this was just one point in this phase diagram of CDT. It was not in the continuum limit, and to really be able to compare something which makes sense, you would first have to follow this in the continuum limit and then extract the coefficient.
And then for Renata, is that something that's sensible to do, is to extract that in the continuum limit?
Well, the thing is, we don't really know how to relate, you know, like the flows with even in, well, with what happens in our phase diagram. So we don't really have good control what this should be. And it's actually not even entirely clear what it means to be inside a phase and what, you know, it means to approach the transition lines. Of course, the standard folklore is, of course, we need to approach these transition lines in order for the continuum to hold and universality, et cetera, to happen. But so I have been less involved in this, but, you know, Ambion and friends have tried in recent weeks and months to kind of set up some relation between the FRG flows and what we see. And it doesn't really match very well. And there are scenarios where it seems that even within the phases, you know, the continuum limit should happen inside the phases. So I think this is just not well understood, and it's premature. One has to be really careful not to be comparing, you know, apples and pears. So an easy way of comparing these things, also with us, we have, you know, various, of course, three parameters, you know, that are sitting there, for instance, translating between lattice units and physical units. So there's also freedom there. So it should be done with great care. It's nice to see that some aspects can be reproduced, but kind of comparing numbers in absolute terms, I think that's probably a stretch at this time.
Let me jump in here. So Renate introduced NP world and NP world. So to remind you, that was a non-perturbative approach, which starts very crazy, and where you supposedly cannot introduce an effective metric and so on, and then the main issue is to go down to the classical limit. and P world, where you start with more smooth concepts and the metric, and then you have the issue to go to what you might call a UV completion, or also the non NP world would complain, what does UV mean? But of course, we should try to connect these two worlds. So what would be the a new view? So that is, for all the speakers, be the most promising avenue to connect these two worlds. And let us start with Astrid, but keep it short. Keep it to one idea. What is the most promising one?
Yeah, so I would maybe say that asymptotic safety could actually act as sort of a bridge between the NP world and the P world, because of this property that it is to some extent non-perturbative as a quantum field theory of the metric. But of course, in Renate's list, it falls more on the P world side. And so this idea that I briefly discussed in my talk, that asymptotic safety could be a sort of intermediate regime that connects a quantum gravity regime that is really non-perturbative to low energy physics, in the sense of physics below the Planck scale that we know is mostly perturbative. I think that is I'm not sure whether it's the most promising idea, but it's an idea that I think is worth to be explored in more detail. So asymptotic safety as a sort of bridge between the NP world and the P world.
Bob, do you want to comment?
I guess in my case, the very high energy limit was perturbative. Mm-hmm. And the low energy theory is weak. And the strong interaction is in the middle. But I guess I think that's unusual to have a perturbative, a well-behaved description of high-energy quantum gravity. Is there any other approach that can do that? In the non-local approach, Benjamin was talking about scattering, but not of gravitons. Can you see any way that you could get sensible cross sections at very high energies?
Well, the problem first of all comes with defining gauge invariant asymptotic states, right? Like a graviton, as we usually use it, is not gauge invariant. So it's maybe a bit hard to make a sensible object in the first place. So it's certainly not an HH to HH scattering. It should be something like a curvature scattering, maybe, and that's really complicated, probably. So I don't think that I would know right away how to compute it.
But can you even imagine how you would avoid blowing up amplitudes and cross sections?
So one mechanism is asymptotic safety, right? So that's the whole idea, that at high energies, since everything is scale invariant, you cannot, S is E squared, and if you do not have a scale, you cannot have a rise in energy. So that's the kind of idea behind asymptotic safety, which should tame amplitudes.
But naively, you have four derivatives or higher in all your interaction terms.
You have, in general, you have infinitely many derivatives. So the point is that they should combine in such a way that at high energies, the amplitude is scale invariant. So you cannot have a polynomial growth.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to comment. Yes, I want to comment. Since anyway, I created the P and the NP world. I mean, of course, it doesn't mean there's no crossover, but I think observables are key. Observables, and also really in the sense of, you know, well-defined gauge invariant objects. I mean, of course, that's the lesson we know exactly from gauge field theory, but it's even the more true, I would say, in the context of gravity. So to have to compare also observables, and not to compare elements of the formalism. So, and that even, you know, going back to the previous point, even renormalization group flows. I mean, you know, a coupling constant, that's not an observable per se, right? So one has to be really careful there. So observables that can bridge this divide also between high energy and low energy, and there's some, yeah, maybe the, in cosmology, there are some candidates, some of which I mentioned.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of very much agreeing with both Renate and Astrid, and we should look at something like a scattering cross-section or something like that in terms of form factors, and then there's exactly this bridge. Like, we have low energy limit where we should expect something like GR, and then there's some transition regime which we have to describe, for example, with the renormalization group.
So I think I agree with Renate and Benjamin about basically, of course, if you have some non-perturbed information and you can compute some four-point function, you'll be able maybe non-perturbatively to see what is the scattering between two gravitons in principle. But coming from a perturbative QFT side, for instance, if we just take quadratic gravity, which is a strictly normalizable quantum field theory, in that case, you see that if you just try to compute a scattering between two gravitons, even in the perturbative framework, which is renormalizable, at some point you will have some growth at three level if you just take two gravitons. And this is the same that happens also in GR. You really have at three level the same amplitude. And in some way, I would see this as some maybe indication that gravity is a bit more special than other renormalizable, perturbatively renormalizable quantum field theory. And somehow this bridge between perturbative and non-perturbative could be also, let's say, in this connection between perturbative and non-perturbative, maybe black hole physics could play a role, because in a way, when we imagine like energy scattering, trans-Planckian scattering, in some scenario we can have like, I don't know, energies confined in distances which are smaller than the spatial radius of the system. So it may be that somehow there is some physics, which is black hole in this case, that should not be neglected. Of course, how to take this into account, I don't know, maybe through asymmetric safety, you automatically take into account of this feature without maybe even thinking about the black hole being there. But from my point of view, I mean, just starting from the perturbative QFT side, it would be nice to see how you really bridge and try to, let's say, take into account these black hole states, which could play a role at higher energies.
Okay, any questions from the audience? Yeah,
Seth, we start with Seth. Great, thank you. The question for Renate, and that is, you gave a distance scale over which you had results 4 to 20 Planck lengths. I wonder if you could say something about all those characters. Why 4? Is the Planck length the physical length in the theory? And why 20?
Ah, very good. Yeah. I didn't have time to comment on that, but it's an excellent question. So it's not put in by hand by saying, oh, a lattice spacing that should be like one Planck length. No. So where the statement about, you know, the identification of lattice units and physical units comes from is from a comparison of one of the observables. So in that case, you know, I mentioned we can look at the three volume as a function of proper time. And that's also, you know, something that Benjamin commented on from the FRG side, they can also look at. So you can simply define a correlator, a volume-volume correlator. And that, you know, in some semi-classical, it has a certain expected dependence on G Newton. And from measuring this, you know, really on the lattice, and, you know, comparing with that expectation, you get this specific identification of the units. That's right. So that's kind of the window where we can reliably measure. Because you're sitting on a lattice, so this is about slightly dependent on how you choose your Bergh couplings. That is about, you know, like 20 Planck lengths across. So that's the linear size of this thing. Of course, it's 4D. So there is a lot of volume in there. But, you know, our resolution, of course, is also bounded. Yeah. So, of course, you don't trust anything that happens at one or two lattice lengths. So this window I gave comes from, you know, the limitations, both from, you know, large lattices, the absolute size of our simulations, and also, of course, you know, you get finite size effect. So is this kind of a, you know, to give you an idea of where we kind of reliably can measure. That's this window.
Lee?
Okay, can I be heard? Good. To me, there's a very different approach to observables in classical and quantum gravity, which I call the views approach. And I just wanted to know if any of you can tell me what's wrong with this or why it's not being better pursued. The idea is that we make use of the idea that every event in space-time is unique. And we pick events in space-time by virtue of the uniqueness of their past light cones, what's seen looking down their past light cones. And using that, we can distinguish events and ask questions about them. And that is the space-time diffeomorphism event. Thank you.
So you want us all to comment on this?
If anybody has anything to comment.
Which approach are you saying?
Causal views.
Oh, causal views.
Sorry? What's the name of the approach? Causal views. Okay.
Causal views.
Okay. I don't know if I...
Well, I'm insufficiently familiar, but I don't know, you know, how far you get. I mean, we are talking here, you know, what I talked about was at the level of observables, measurables. So it has progressed very much, of course. You know, all the details are there in place. And I think the thing is then to, maybe to pick up on your earlier question this morning, well, let's compare what the results, you know, what results you get for kind of observables that I also can study on the lattice. So, and
very good. Okay.
Maybe I'm insufficiently familiar with your answer to that question.
Okay. Well, we can do that. So that's, I'm happy to wait.
You've already ruled out the possibility that quantum gravity is nothing but a quantum field theory?
Oh, I've certainly ruled it out. That quantum gravity is just quantum field theory.
You've ruled that out.
Yes. Let me not be so strong. In my own thinking, which doesn't have to agree with yours.
No, but this is a very old idea of quantum gravity being a quantum field theory.
Sure, but...
And it's been neglected for decades.
If I understand what you mean by a quantum field theory, you mean a theory built on a manifold, which is a classical manifold, and built on that is some fluctuating fields.
Yes.
So the classical manifold comes first, and then you have some fluctuating fields.
In the deep UV, where it's asymptotically free, I think you can do that.
Yes. And I don't want to spend the time unless you want to, but I have for myself at least, long lists of reasons why I don't expect that to work out. But I'm not telling other people what to do. I'm not saying don't do that if that inclines you.
Yannick.
Yes, there have been. Test? Okay. There have been some questions on Zoom for Renate. One of them is by Francesco Benzo Lustosa. They ask what causal dynamical triangulation simulations of quantum curvature can say about the approach to singularities in the early universe. Can we model something like evolution?
I can't hear you.
Sorry.
Closer to the microphone and slower.
What causal dynamical triangulation simulations of quantum curvature can say about the approach to singularities in the early universe? Can we model something like the evolution of quantum geometries to obtain models of quantum bounces?
Resolution. I mean, really, where the universe has become very small. So, you know, whatever we could say about, let's say, these volume profiles and these volume-volume correlators. That is kind of the comparison with the semi-classical regime, and we cannot look at higher order terms or correction terms to this. So that's simply not what the simulations allow. And generally speaking, I mean, okay, the gist of maybe some of the questions, of course, and has to be careful. So we have, what we are studying is, you know, the properties of kind of the ground state of the system. So this is like, you know, the vacuum, the mother of all vacua. And you don't necessarily, number one, of course, you have very little in terms of analytical control, and this is why I put in the health warning. You know, most questions that are kind of semi-classically motivated, that refer to a background, and even things like scattering, they're impossible to formulate operationally at the Planck scale, or at least, I don't know how to do it. If you do it, we may be able to simulate it. So, and I think part of the question had a little bit this character. So, yeah, no, we cannot resolve, say anything about the initial singularity. Will we ever be able to? I don't know. Of course, we are closer to a regime which we claim is highly quantum, but you know, the origin of the universe itself, and then the question of the boundary conditions and their influence also comes in. So that may be asking too much of any theory of quantum gravity, possibly.
Yannick, did you have more questions?
Yes, there are more questions on Zoom. One is, someone is asking whether you could elaborate a bit about the quantum Ricci curvature that you introduce. Do you mean that you have a quantum tensor that reduces to Ricci in the classical limit?
Yeah, so it's a long and very interesting story, which I try to cut very short. So the problem is, so we work with piecewise flat geometries, and of course there is a time-honored way of talking about curvature, also according to Reggie, which is in the deficit angles. But it turns out that in four dimensions, in this non-perturbative regime, even it's kind of the integrated Ricci curvature is very badly divergent, and we don't understand how to renormalize it properly. So for a long time, we didn't have a meaningful notion of curvature. So however, it turns out in mathematics, people study Ricci curvature on more general metric spaces that are not necessarily smooth. So in particular, the notion is called Olivet curvature, and I found this and I adapted this to use in these quantum geometries. So this is, of course, a longer story, as I said, but this is not, you shouldn't think of it as a tensor, but it's a notion that if you evaluate it on a smooth Riemannian space, it does reproduce really the Ricci elements of the full information about the Ricci tensor. If you evaluate it on more general spaces, well, a priori you don't know what you will be getting, but you have a formulation that only depends on doesn't need tensor calculus. It only depends on measuring, being able to measure volumes and geodesic distances. So, and it's beautiful, and there is just a mathematical story to it, which is also interesting.
Okay, let me throw in general questions again to everyone. And that is a point about seeing your approach as a fundamental idea, which would be sufficient to address quantum gravity over all scales, or rather as a tool. And Astrid, maybe you start with your two scenarios, because I understood you can make everyone happy.
Yeah, I can try to. So I think maybe one answer would be that I think it's important in quantum gravity that we really go back to asking not so much sort of questions about mathematical theories, but really stay more conservative in the sense of asking what is sort of the minimal thing that we need a quantum theory of gravity to do in order to sort of to tell us about quantum fluctuations of gravity in a sort of most minimalistic sense or only as much as we need it. And there isn't any evidence that we have that we need to go into a very deep non-perturbative regime. There isn't any evidence that we have that we would need to sort of go far beyond quantum field theory. And so I think we can sort of stay very, very conservative and minimalistic, and in some sense don't need to care as much about this question of whether or not we are building a truly fundamental theory that covers all sorts of possibilities of quantum gravity, of what quantum gravity could be. But in some sense, we can just ask how far can we actually extend something like an effective field theory approach to quantum gravity. One point of view on asymptotic safety would be that this is exactly what it does. It pushes the effective field theory approach to the Planck scale and a little bit beyond. But really, from the point of view of connecting to the real world, this question of whether it's fundamental or not really doesn't matter so much. And I think that would be a thing that I think can be useful to consider more in all approaches to quantum gravity, this question of what is it that we really need quantum gravity to do, and do we really need to go into deeply non-perturbative regimes and far away from concepts that make sense for all of the other fundamental interactions?
Thank you. Luca, do you want to?
I can start. Okay, so the question is like, I mean, from my point of view, I think there exists no perfect theory and no theory of everything. So I think what we can really do is like, given our current understanding of theoretical frameworks, theoretical tools we have, and given our understanding of whatever we see and observe in the universe, what is the simplest framework, and within this framework, what is the simplest theory that we can write down and try to be consistent and explain whatever we see. And I think that at least in the perturbative QFT approach, we have a simple way to do that, because if we just follow a bit history and we see what happened with the other interactions, we were just asking for like some guiding principle and we were selecting theory. And I think one criteria that unify a bit, for instance, electromagnetism, weak interaction, and QCD is that they are strictly renormalizable interactions, okay? And so the another question to ask, to be as simple as possible, is like, let's do the same for gravity and see whether we can describe something. And if we do that for gravity, of course, we get a quadratic curvature Lagrangian that we can use also to do an experiment, and we can even describe physics beyond Einstein general relativity, for instance, inflation. Okay. So in this sense, I would say, this is already, I think, a great success of like using some principle from QFT to select Lagrangians and do like even like trying to explain experiments, okay? Of course, this does not mean that this theory should be true everywhere, like up to, I don't know, very short distance scales, or we know that perturbative QFT by definition is perturbative and at some point it should break down in principle. Even like asymptotic, even the series like are asymptotic, so we know that if we go at very high order, at some point it may happen that maybe multiplicity of Feynman diagrams will maybe blow up and we cannot trust the approach anymore. So in this sense, I see like the perturbative QFT approach just a good starting point to like say, okay, given this principle, this is our starting Lagrangian, okay? And then maybe starting from there, we can discuss like features that go beyond the perturbative approach. So for instance, we can add non-perturbative effects and see what happens. Like we do also, I think, with the, I don't know, standard model a bit, right? We start with some perturbative field theory, we select the Lagrangian somehow, and then with the Lagrangian, we try to describe also some non-perturbative physics, okay? And I think in this way, okay, of course, as I said, we are not sure whether we can describe really everything. It may happen that 100 years, we will see something that cannot be described just with perturbative quantum field theory. I'm speaking about gravity. And then some non-perturbative effects or some new ideas to be introduced. But I think currently, given our understanding of theoretical framework and experiments, just by using like perturbative quantum field theory, we can get something. And of course, it's very natural to also ask about non-perturbative questions. But so in this sense, I'm not so pessimistic about having a theory which is just a perturbative quantum field theory, because somehow it's still useful to describe even physics beyond Einstein general relativity. Okay, so this is more or less my opinion.
Benjamin?
This question is also a little bit about universality, do you agree? Mm-hmm. In that sense, if I want to be polemic, I could say it's not really well posed whether my theory holds all the way to the UV, because if we find some degree of universality, then the microscopic details should not influence the large-scale structure, and that's what we measure. And maybe the second point is I'm very much also a fan of shut up and calculate, because in the end we want to get numbers that we can compare, and I think it's there's of course some value to have like general discussions about principles, but in the end I want to see, I don't know, give me the mass of the Higgs in your quantum gravity theory, and then we can go to experimentalist and compare.
Renata.
Yes, well obviously I should contradict some of these statements. So I think, you know, in terms of non-perturbative quantum gravity, I think we are seeing that there is something rather than nothing. You know, I claimed, of course, you know, we're doing, in lattice quantum gravity, we're doing something universal and there are absolutely no exotic ingredients. So we are seeing kind of, you know, properties of a quantum field theory of quantum gravity, if it exists in some to be defined sense. So, the trouble of effective descriptions is, of course, the reliability, right? How far can I trust, you know, a series which I know diverges very highly, and I'm just computing, you know, some of its properties. You know, in the worst case, maybe I shouldn't even trust my first correction terms. We just don't know. So we want to be reassured that there is something to back it up. And I, you know, even like the existence of a U fixed point, you want some independent method that backs this up. And I would say even the lattice methods are, of course, in principle, a way of doing it. And what we also do is we are setting benchmarks. And of course, you know, if perturbation theory would work for gravity, well, we would be done. But we, you know, there are of course things that don't work, and there are hopefully, I would say, surprises out there which make, if you like, the sum of all the terms look totally different than what we suspect from our semi-classical consideration. So in a way, that's what we're hoping for. And the spectral dimension story was, in a way, I think, an aspect of that, which is not, you cannot discover perturbatively, you know, a dimension that's not four, really. So that's an example. You know, you set a benchmark and you say, okay, look, can you compute this? And then, yeah, people go away and try and compute it. But the initial idea came from just looking at this in a very non-perturbative way. So there may be, hopefully, there are more stories out there.
Bob?
Well, QCD, I think, is an example of a theory, a UV complete theory, that explains high energy and low energy, everything. It does have strong interactions, but we live with that. So the dream is, can we do the same thing for gravity? And I just think not enough effort has been devoted to that approach for many, many years. Whether we can do it or not, well, that's yet to be seen, whether it can be described in a way and understood in a way that people can come to accept. But that's where the analogy with other theories of the real world that we already know and live with, I think that's important, to bring what we know from other areas like QCD and take it to quantum gravity.
So can I pick up on the QCD? Of course. Yeah. You know, there's of course a whole non-perturbative low energy sector of QCD, which we've been exploring with lattice methods, which are extremely powerful by now.
Right.
So, and that is part of the story of understanding what the theory tells us.
The lattice is only part of the story of understanding QCD. You have to
it's
do
the non-perturbative part of the story.
That's right. So at very high energies, it's very little use.
Yes.
And you have to, but in that case, you have the perturbative theory, so you're all set.
Yeah. So. But you know, if we were as far in understanding, you know, the spectrum of quantum gravity in the same way, we know that from lattice simulations we understand the spectrum of QCD, that would be a very happy situation.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, more questions. So there was John already previously. and then it will be Kelly.
Yeah, I have a question for Luca. The issue is that 33 years ago I published Non-Local Quantum Gravity in Physical Review. It's based on the Einstein-Hilbert action.
Sorry?
It's based on? It's unitary. The loops are all finite to all orders and so forth. No ghosts. So the question is, why include higher derivative quadratic contributions with potential ghost problems?
Yeah. So.
Because the theory is already finite at the Einstein-Hilbert action level.
So I think, I mean, if I understood the question is, if you want to introduce non-locality in gravity, why you have to introduce higher curvatures? Okay. That's the question. Well, I think that at least if you have like a diffeomorphism invariant theory and you have also metric compatibility to be true, there is no way to just keep the Einstein-Hilbert term and make it non-local, because even if you act with some form factors, this will just act as a covariant derivative, just as a total derivative, and you can basically neglect the higher derivative contribution acting on that. So the only way to really introduce like some non-local information through form factors is by adding extra term where you have to sandwich between some higher curvature. So I'm not exactly now, I don't know exactly the details of your paper, but if you are somehow modifying non-locally the Einstein-Hilbert part, maybe you are giving up to some other assumption from the beginning, because otherwise there is no way to make it non-local. Because we just have, like, for instance, some function of box acting on Ricci scalar, but if, I mean, you have nothing else contracting this, you can always basically avoid, I mean, you can always cancel this contribution, it will just be like total derivatives. So, yeah, this is basically the simplest way to understand why you really need higher curvature to have some four factors which will play a role, right? You really have to sandwich, otherwise you cannot introduce this non-locality just at the level of Einstein-Hilbert action.
Yeah, yeah, just continuing, Bob. I know we've talked about this separately, using QCD as a kind of an example. The thing is, QCD itself actually isn't a healthy theory in the ultraviolet. It has what the Russians call zero charge, or what Fredkin called zero charge, at the Landau pole. Fredkin hated the term Landau pole for obvious reasons. So non-perturbatively, by itself, it's a sick theory. If it fits into a grand unified theory, it becomes okay.
You're talking about QCD?
Yeah, because it's non-asymptotically free.
QCD?
Yeah.
I thought it was.
QCD. Sorry, take it away. QED. Excuse me.
Yeah,
take the C out. Yeah, replace C with E.
You know, I was talking about QCD.
QCD is a better example, yes.
Yes.
Because, yeah. Because it's asymptotically free.
That's right.
But if you try it with the Maxwell theory, with the scalar QED, you run into that sort of problem.
That's right.
So I don't know if those sorts of non-perturbative issues are really totally separable from the issues that you were discussing about what really are the asymptotic states. That's all I wanted to say. But excuse me. No, I didn't mean QCD, I meant QED.
Okay. Lee?
I want to add a little more to that. What sector of physics does QCD describe?
Sorry?
What sector of the physical world does QCD describe? My point is that there's none. And the standard model describes a segment of her world. But the segment, the standard model is not consistent. And I don't think you can name any quantum field theory, in quotes, that describes an actual sector of nature that is known to be consistent. In fact, it is not known to be inconsistent. So I think the claim that there just are four-dimensional non-interacting quantum field theories is not held up by mathematics so far.
Just QCD in isolation, if that's all there was.
If I were a mathematician, which I'd be a terrible one, I might be interested in QCD. But QCD corresponds to no regime of physical theory that is of physics. And all the theories that have a chance to correspond to a real region of physics are known not to be consistent. And I think we should learn something from that.
Well, as we just mentioned, though, QCD has been studied on the lattice, and it's consistent as far as that approach.
His point is it doesn't describe the universe, because we have more than QCD.
Yes, all I'm saying is it's an example. It's a template for the closest thing I could come to as being the gold standard of what we should strive for in our physical theories. It's the closest.
Abai?
So I'd like to change the subject just slightly. The first question I wanted to ask is really about both Renata and Astrid. Things that you've done is really in the Euclidean signature, is that correct? The actual calculations, the final results, the most important one. So maybe Astrid can go first.
So most of the results are in Euclidean signature, that's correct. There is one recent paper that also Benjamin highlighted in his talk of the spectral function of the graviton, which is really a calculation in Lorentzian signature. But that's an exception. The rest of the literature is in Euclidean signature on asymptotic safety.
Why could one get away from, the problems of going to the Lorentzian signature in this particular problem?
So basically you then have to think about how to regularize the Lorentzian form momentum and the price that you pay to introduce a cutoff that is compatible with the Lorentzian propagator is that you do get additional UV divergences in the theory for which you have to introduce a second regulator. So in some sense, you have to introduce two sets of regulators to fully regularize the theory. So it just becomes technically more challenging. But in principle, something like the functional RG equation can formally be written down in Lorentzian signature without any problems. The challenge is just that in the application, it is much more straightforward to impose a cutoff in Euclidean signature, and in Lorentzian signature, you're encountering these problems of either breaking Lorentzian invariants or having to introduce several regulators or regularizations.
Exactly.
How
could the breaking of Lorentzian invariants be avoided in this particular example that you are giving?
I have to admit I would have to go back to look at the details of the paper. But I think the price to pay is exactly by introducing a sort of sharp Kalman semantic-like cutoff, which doesn't break Lorentz invariants, but it doesn't fully regularize all of the UV divergences. So that is sort of the price that you pay.
But we don't know any such thing, right? You might put some cutoff, which is, okay, maybe we should talk later. So then Renata, your calculations, the actual computations were done all in Euclidean signature, is that correct?
Yeah, we start out purely Lorentzian, then at the regularized level we have a weak quotation, and then we compute in the Euclidean sector. Indeed.
Yeah. So the sitter is really four sphere. The sitter is plus signature.
Say again.
When you say ground state and so on, the sitter,
yeah,
that is really
it's,
the plus
it's a state
plus.
Of lowest Euclidean action.
Euclidean action, right.
Yes.
And then at one stage, you mentioned that somehow your gravitons are not gauge invariant. Why not? What's the problem?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Yeah, at one stage you mentioned, you said in passing, yeah, but the your gravitons are not gauge invariant, so there is a problem with some calculation. Why are they not gauge invariant?
So the problem is that, you have a gauge theory, right? And to do renormalization group computations, you have to fix the gauge to, not get infinities. And since beta functions are off-shell quantities, they will depend on the gauge, and typically we only look at the RG flow, but once you look at amplitudes, these are observables, so they are gauge invariant by construction. So that is an advantage that over just looking at an RG flow.
So when you say not gauge invariant, you just meant that you're calculating a given gauge, is that right?
Yeah.
But that can be... You can calculate, if you fix the gauge, then the quantity...
Yeah, for fixed gauge, I mean, you can do computations, right? So that's not an issue. The issue is that you're looking at off-shell quantities, as I'm saying. So, and it's not really meaningful to compare off-shell quantities in different gauges.
Right.
But you should look at universal quantities, like the existence of fixed points,
right.
Its critical properties,
right.
Or like more something that you can measure, like an amplitude.
Yeah, and that
was the comment that I wanted to make there, yeah.
Okay. And then, just to everybody, just one question about... I mean, we also heard a talk yesterday about celestial holography, where, you know, it's a powerful machinery to calculate various things, and, you know, one understands the relation of the BMS group and new observables, and there's a whole cottage industry that is going on. Do any of the approaches that were mentioned today make contact with celestial holography? And there, Lorentzian signature is critical, so I would think that it would be somewhat difficult, but maybe there is a way to make contact with that.
So I'm not very familiar with the topic, but I don't know how much, because usually there is some correspondence, but they work, I think, with some two derivative field theories, I guess. They always imagine maybe some standard GR and some two derivative field theory on the bulk. I think even in ADS-CFT, most of the work focuses on that, right?
No, this is asymptotically flat case.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, even when they have this correspondence, I think the main work are, like, just with the two derivative field theory, maybe they can add some correction to it. So I'm not sure how much of these correspondence have been explored with the higher order derivatives or even like non-local operators. I'm really not aware about that. Yeah,
especially the issue of infrared sectors and, you know, the soft theorems and so on. Has that been looked at all in any of the approaches in either asymptotic safety or in CDT or... soft theorems, infrared issues, infrared finiteness.
Yeah. I'm doing strictly bulk physics, so
Right.
I'm looking at, if you like, the Hilbert space, of course, and I cannot say anything meaningful about asymptotic states.
But also, I think the soft theorem should be quite universal, right? At least the zeroth order and the soft theorems should be quite universal.
Yes.
The zeroth order and the next to the linear order, right? And
yeah,
I guess if you just are looking for, like, I mean, like a Lagrangian where you have some UV modification, maybe you will not affect at least these lower orders of the soft theorem. So I would not expect...
This is not so obvious to me because of the, you know, as soon as you have got higher order thing, then even the initial value problem changes in this, you know, it's not clear to me that...
Yeah, I mean, just think about let's say, amplitude side, like if you just really look at these Weinberg soft theorems, I'm not referring like to the asymptotic symmetry side. So at least from the soft theorem amplitude, I guess the first leading order, and I mean those, I would not expect any change at that level. Yeah, of sure, high order you will see some effects because you get some non-universal correction, and maybe you will see an effect of these four factors, I guess, and so on.
So I see. So you think the soft theorems might continue, but the relation with asymptotic symmetries and so on would be probably...
Yeah, I really am not familiar with this. Let's say. Corresponds between bulk and flat celestial sphere there, so I cannot really, I don't want to make wrong statement, yeah, so.
Thank you.
Hi.
So I have a question for Renata about your talk. I think on one of the last slides you said something like matter doesn't matter near the Planck scale, like on Planck scale physics, as far as like when you couple these CDT models to matter, the effect on the space-time was, I guess, small or maybe negligible. Could you maybe just elaborate on what you meant by that, like, statement, like, matter doesn't matter close to the Planck scale?
Well, you know, it's partly a pun on what Astrid likes to say, namely that matter does matter. So, it was reporting, of course, I didn't have time to go into this. So, matter can be easily coupled, you know, in principle, even straightforwardly, to these dynamical gravitating, you know, configurations. So, the ideas in the path integral, you simply have an additional for each of the geometric configurations. You put a full matter sum, whatever you want. I mean, gauge fields, spin fields, you know, Gaussian fields, and then you have a combined interacting system. Of course, your geometry, you're still in that Planckian regime I was talking about. So the question is, well, what quantities do you study to understand how the system behaves? So it's not so straightforward to come up with interesting new quantities, but of course we can look at the geometric quantities we are also looking at for pure gravity. And for those, so far, we haven't seen an inference when we've coupled matter of the matter, you know, kind of back onto the geometry. So what that means, well, it's just an indication, you know, it could be that matter doesn't matter, and maybe the, you know, the geometric degrees of freedom are, or whatever we, you know, we see there is, you know, dominates at the Planck scale.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a quick follow-up question?
I would, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Is it known, so if you have fermions on CDT simulations, is it known whether you have a sign problem?
Well, we haven't studied fermions, but actually the PISA group is aiming to do that. We don't expect anything new to happen compared to what happens on fixed lattices.
But maybe an issue could be that, Renate, you look rather from the UV side, and asymptotic safety looks from the infrared side.
Well, it's again where these two things meet, right?
Yeah, maybe Astrid wants to comment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Renata's results or the results Renata is referring to are necessarily in contradiction with the sort of meta-matters results in asymptotic safety, because also when we couple matter fields, we see some impact on the asymptotically safe fixed point. But you have to go to a regime with quite a lot of matter fields for the fixed point to sort of change dramatically or potentially even get lost. So I wouldn't necessarily expect matter to matter in the sense that if you couple a few scalar fields or a few vectors, that suddenly the quantum geometry should be totally different, because also in the FRG calculations, we see a fixed point with largely similar properties. Matter matters, at least in most of the approximations, when you add really a lot of matter fields, so that even if you do sort of a naive counting of the degrees of freedom, just the number of matter fields largely overwhelms the number of degrees of freedom in the gravitational field. That this is when at least in some of the calculations, matter really starts to matter in the sense that the fixed point potentially gets lost there. But so I don't think there's currently a contradiction between Renata's matter doesn't matter in a certain regime to the statement that I'm making about matters. And yes, there's a whole other story that Bianca was alluding to about the interplay of gravity with matter on the infrared properties of matter. But that's, I think, something that in CDT hasn't been considered yet. And it goes more into this question that Benjamin briefly mentioned earlier, that it would be nice if you could get a calculation of the allowed values for the Higgs mass or some other particle physics quantity from all quantum gravity approaches, and we could compare between each other. And of course, for that, matter matters, and you need to include matter in the calculation.
Okay, thank you. Roberto had a question.
Yeah, I want to return to the point that Lee and Kelly were making. Astrid has shown that if there is an asymptotic and non-trivial fixed point for gravity, that may help with the issue of the Landau pole of QED. It's not a proof, but there is some sign that it does. Now, the question is now for Bob. In your scenario where you have asymptotically free gravity instead, presumably, it wouldn't help with the Landau pole of QED.
No, the matter sector basically has to look after its own. So a QED would have to be embedded in an asymptotically free extension.
So you need a grand unification or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
And then a question for Renata. I like your characterization of CDT as a tool rather than an approach. And so we know that we've been trying to converge between the results of FIG calculation of fixed points and your calculations, your simulations. Now, in the theory space that we explore with the functional RG, you can clearly see that there is a Gaussian fixed point that corresponds to the free to the low energy gravity, the fixed point of Einstein at low energy. There is another free fixed point that corresponds to higher derivative gravity. And then there's a Reuter fixed point, which is non-trivial. So my question is, can you see all these things, or can you discriminate between these things with the lattice?
Yeah, well, no. Well, we still would be happy to verify any of them. We have looked in the phase diagram, and we have, some limited control over renormalization group flows, but where the question comes back, what on earth is it you are keeping fixed? Because we're working with different in a different language, right? And so we have these observables, and we are defining these trajectories by, keeping certain ratios of observables fixed. It's also not very clear how that maps to your way of looking at it, but we haven't, massaging what we can do and see, we haven't seen evidence of this UV fixed point. It doesn't mean it's not there. It's also very, it's very difficult to measure reliably close to these second order of transition lines, which we do have, of course, in the picture. So there is no breakthrough there yet.
Yeah.
Hi. So I got a question for Astrid. So I wanted you to comment a bit on the on what is expected to what's the expected fate of black hole entropy in asymptotic safety. Like, should we recover area law, or should we have some? And the reason why I'm asking is because if in a conformal, the quantum field theory which has no scales, right? I mean, I would expect entropy to be kind of like extensive with the energy or with something like that. And then I guess that the picture is, if you're going to recover area law, is that there has to be some sort of RG flow that recovers that, and seems like a very drastic change in number of degrees of freedom. So I just wanted to ask, maybe what's the fate of it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, first of all, one has to say that there are some arguments that say that in a conformal field theory, of course, you can't get the area law for the entropy. And here it's important to distinguish, right, between scale symmetric theories and conformal theories. That's not the same thing. And so this is not an argument that is enough to conclude that you don't get an area law in asymptotic safety. People have looked at the entropy in these renormalization group improved black holes, and they do basically recover the area law for sort of infrared or large black holes, which is, I think, also what you would expect, because there you just flow back into a classical regime of gravity. And whether the area law really continues to hold for sort of Planck scale black holes, I don't think we have enough understanding of black holes and asymptotic safety to really be able to answer the question whether asymptotic safety simply gives you some subleading corrections to the area law, or whether it really changes the behavior of the entropy.
Thanks. And if we could ask like a quick question to Renata. So you were saying it was very nice that you should think of CDT as a tool rather than
as was being mentioned. Are there any attempts to apply this tool, you know, to, you know, string theory in 10 dimensions, or the supersymmetric ones, to try and predict some, to try to connect with maybe holography or any other corner of string theory? Is that possible?
It's not the most obvious thing to try and do, you know, because I would say, well, the beauty of this is this non-perturbative window. Right. And of course, there's so that's deep. This is the NP world. So, you know, I'm kind of unapologetically non-perturbative, and there is obviously this tension relating to, you know, more classical-looking formulations. I would say, yeah, you know, never say never, but it's very non-obvious how this would relate to string theory. The issue is, you know, the sign of the cosmological constant is one obvious discrepancy. And then, you know, in principle, we could have discovered that, you know, measuring, say, the spectral, the Hausdorff dimension on short distances, in principle, that could have become larger than 4. Yeah? So then we just say, hey, here we have some non-perturbative evidence. Oh, maybe there are some rolled up little dimensions hiding there, you know, microscopically. But we saw the opposite. So we saw a dimensional reduction.
Thanks.
Yannick?
Yes, so I have two questions from Zoom. One I assume is for Bob. So the question is whether you predict that the 2-to-2 hole holds more information than a black hole of the same mass, and whether that negates the holographic principle.
Yeah, I mentioned it could have somewhat higher entropy than a black hole, but it negates what?
The holographic principle.
What's the quantum gravity principle?
Holographic.
Holographic. Does it? Well, then there must be something wrong with that principle then. Because, I mean, I've got an explicit solution, and I can easily calculate the entropy, right?
The other question is just a short one for Renate. Michelle Nardelli is asking for a recent review paper about CDT, so she found quantum curvature as key to the quantum universe, and just wondering whether you have a more recent review paper.
Well, there's an overdue encyclopedia article which I've promised someone who's sitting two seats down from me. That should be written within the next few weeks. But yeah, the most recent thing is the classical quantum gravity, but that's already a few years old. I wrote an article about the quantum Ricci curvature, quantum curvature, which also has part of CDT. But yeah, we're working on it.
Okay.
Can I ask a question to Bob?
Yeah.
So I just would like to know your opinion. So sometimes people say that quadratic gravity is asymptotically free, but this is true only if we choose a specific sign for the coefficients of the R squared term, for instance, right? Because if the coefficient is positive, you will not have asymptotically freedom, but you keep a healthy, let's say, degrees of freedom, this spin zero. If you get it, if you choose a negative sign, you will have a tachyon, but then you may have asymptotically free. So what is your opinion about that? And what's your take? Which one? Yeah, I mean, for instance, if you would like to, I don't know, describe, so I know we already had a discussion once, but if you would like to describe inflation with a healthy scalar degree of freedom from R square, you will not, you cannot have a tachyon degree of freedom there. Yeah, that's why I would care. Yes.
Also, I mean, there's more in the world that you could throw in there, right?
There's
more in the world you can throw in there. It's not just the vial squared R squared.
No, sure, sure. But you will have anyway. if you want that it's not really free, also in the coupling, you will have a tachyonic degree of freedom that in principle you should care about, right?
Well, you have to see what the norm. I don't know what the renormalization group equations do when you throw it. I mean, it depends on how much matter you put in there, right? Those coefficients change all over the place. So that's just a statement about pure vial squared R gravity.
But you may have like some degree of freedom that could.
Well, but you could change the coefficient. I'm not. I don't know, in fact, what the answer to that is. Mm-hmm. But it's about the R squared term anyway.
So yeah.
It's the whole issue about the ghost is.
No. I'm not separate topic. Thinking about the ghost problem. I'm just thinking about like you have a theory which is essentially free only if you admit a tachyon.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. So, is it something good? Maybe it's better to have a healthy spin zero and not care about full asymptotic freedom in the theory.
That's well, also this general question of what do you do with the tachyon? That just means you're sitting on the top of the mountain and you're supposed to roll downhill into the valley and go re-expand around it.
Sure.
So
but actually want to comment?
I like those answers. Yeah.
I mean, do you have a view on? I mean, this is, from my point of view, this is starting to get greedy. If you have an answer to what the bloody ghost is doing, that I sort of like. And now, if you also want to do inflation on top, you, as we say, you used to want a cream on top. It's asking an awful lot out of one poor Lagrangian.
Okay, let me ask one more general question. Again, picking up on something Renata said, on kind of real experiments, you know, what is the hope there to get direct access to quantum gravity versus numerical experiments? What is a more promising approach? I mean, numerical maybe in the sense of also calculational. You know, Astrid, do you want to comment shortly? We have like 1 minute for everyone.
Yeah, I think we definitely need both, right? I mean, we absolutely need numerical experiments and we need as many calculations of observables in the sense of diffeomorphism and invariant quantities that we can compare between approaches. But I think we also need connection to real experiments and to observables in a more down-to-earth sense when we do have a flat background that we can expand upon as we do have in our real universe at low energies. And where we can calculate quantum, where you can calculate particle physics observables, and I think here there's a lot of potential from different quantum gravity approaches to also make this connection to particle physics that asymptotic safety has done. So absolutely, we need both real experiments and numerical experiments.
Renato?
Yeah, well, I think I emphasize that was also part of my story, how important these numerical experiments can be. Part one, two. You know, figure out what the predictions of our own theories and models are, right? And yeah, just to have numbers to compare. So I'm absolutely not against relating to real experiments. What I was saying is it's unlikely that they will guide our theory building. So I think, yeah, we should, the numerical side is underappreciated and it shouldn't be like that. We should, you know, it's a unique window on the non-perturbative world, and we really should squeeze out whatever is there in terms of information.
Benjamin?
Yeah, I think I can. I agree with what has been said, and kind of reiterating. I think it's a very non-trivial constraint to get, already if you have your favorite quantum theory of gravity, to get out the standard model physics on top of that. I think there's a really non-trivial constraint to get everything under one hat. And I think this should be, at least from my perspective, the main priority before we talk about more exotic things like what happens in a black hole or something like that, because you first have to make sure that you're actually describing the real world before you get into the regime, which is just out of reach experimentally at the moment.
Luca?
Yeah, so just one question to you very quickly, that you mean that it's still not clear how to couple like quantum gravity to the standard model?
No, I'm just saying that you have to get a lot of numbers right? You have to show that in the theory space of your quantum gravity theory, the standard model is one point there. Like, it's in the landscape.
Okay, so you have this opinion of like flowing down to some...
Not even flow. I mean, your theory of quantum gravity must have the standard model as we measure it
sure.
as admissible data point.
But you could also say I want to couple the standard model to some normalizable quantum gravity. And
you pick the theory. I just say you have to agree with the real world.
Yeah, sure. And of course, we need to. But I don't think, like, if you just want to couple, for instance, like in the perturbative QFT approach, at least you want to couple standard model to gravity, you would say that you are not sure whether you can do that, like, consistently, or...
No, it could be that your theory of quantum gravity says the Higgs mass is the same as the top mass.
Ah, okay, you're saying, like, if there is some extra constraint comes from... Sure, but, I mean...
Look, a much simpler thing. I mean, solve all of the Landau poles in the standard model, right? In the QED sector and also in the Higgs Yukawa sector.
So you would like quantum gravity to solve.
That's something that you have to do if you want your theory of quantum gravity plus matter to really be fundamental, right? It's not enough for it to be renormalizable. You have to solve all of the Landau pole problems.
Okay. Yeah, so
and that becomes a non-trivial constraint, right? If in particular, if your quantum theory of gravity is really a truly perturbative theory.
Mm-hmm. So when you mean like recovering the standard model, also to Benjamin, you want standard model but improving some of the problems we have like Landau pole and so on. Okay, that's you want something more anyway. Okay, so yeah, the question was, what was the question? But
what is more hopeful in some sense, real experiments or numerical experiments?
Okay.
What is more promising as
I see.
Falsifying mm-hmm. quantum gravity approaches.
You have to set a time frame, say, within the next 5 to 10 years.
the next 5 to 10 years, where, I don't know, that's a very mm-hmm. small timeline.
I think, yeah, maybe I can comment on both, like experimental, physical, really observation and simulation. I'm not really in the field of this non-perturbative simulation, but talking with also Benjamin recently, I've learned that anyway, this computation, for instance, the spectral density in Lorentz and Singer is a very important result in their field. And I guess if one day you will be able to compute like some like the same for the four-point function, you may really get some idea of how the behavior of the scattering amplitudes could be. And this is something good because conceptually you can say, if I have a nice behavior, then it means that this non-perturbative quantum gravity approach is somehow maybe meaningful. And just observationally, again, I would like to mention again, perturbative QFT approach. Somehow, for me, the fact that we have, anyway, a perturbative framework, which can explain new physics beyond GR, which is, again, Starobinsky inflation, although some people can do also something different with this R square, right? But I think one way to use this extra term is to explain new physics, and this somehow works up to now. And people say that early universe cosmology can be a good arena to test high energy physics, right? And for instance, if you work in like gravitational theories, you can access information about, for instance, the tensor to scalar ratio that people hope to measure in, I don't know, maybe the next years, hopefully. And for instance, from the tensor to scalar ratio, we can also put constraint, okay, on the values of the value square coefficient de Lagrange. Okay, so in this sense, I think that experiments can be still somehow useful to constrain part of the theory in the early universe.
Bob, do you want to comment? We have zero minutes apparently.
Yeah, I think real experiments, because of this possibility that a UV complete theory of gravity may actually give us a replacement for black holes, and so. Gravitational wave echoes is all I need to say.
Okay, thank you for your nice discussions. I thank the audience for the questions.